Good afternoon. So last time we started talking about more about scheduling, talked about some scheduling metrics. We talked about turnaround and wait time as these things which kind of correspond to interactivity, like how fast from when I press a key or when something comes from the network, do I get to respond to that? Talked about throughput, where our main problem was that context switching took time, both from the context switch itself and from the overhead of evicting things from our processor caches. And we talked a bit about, mentioned fairness, this notion that if I have a shared machine, I expect everyone on the machine to be able to actually get CPU time. And the big problem is that many of the times we would optimize, say, a response, the turnaround or wait time or throughput, we would end up making it so it's quite possible that some program would never get to run. This is known as starvation. We went through some simple, trivial scheduling policies and looked at how they did in these metrics in some cases. So that for first come, first served and round robin were our simplest ones. First come, first served, we just execute them in order they come in to completion. We don't take something off the processor unless it has to be taken off, like it has to do I/O, so it can't use the CPU. And round robin was the simplest one, where we say, you have some time limit, you have just generally fixed time limits, and we take you off the CPU and move on to the next process. Then we started actually optimizing for, we started with turnaround time for that responsiveness notion. And we had shortest job first, which was if we didn't do preemption, we just wanted to take the thing which will finish soonest, where for our scheduling problem, typically when we say finish, we mean get to do your next piece of I/O, like wait for more keyboard input. And we had the preemptive version of that, which was shortest remaining time first, where we do the same thing. We take the thing which will finish soonest, but we interrupt things, so something becomes ready while something else is running. Like if I press a key while something else is running, we might run the thing that's responding to that key press, immediately interrupting something else, assuming it's going to finish sooner. Now, and we mentioned that, well, shortest job first and shortest remaining time first don't really work in practice because we can't actually know when things will finish most of the time. And we don't have a good way of finding out. If we ask users, there's not really a reason to believe that they'll even know what the answer is or be able to tell us or want to tell us or have the time to tell us. So we had one approximation, which was a multi-level feedback queue. And this was based on this heuristic that we assume that the last time you use CPU is going to be similar to the next. So if we just adjust where we prioritize you based on the last time you use CPU, we'll do the right thing. And that's what multi-level feedback queues try to do, is they try to set your priority based on how long you're going to use the CPU. And that ends up approximating shortest remaining time first. And we mentioned that this isn't perfect, that you could cheat multi-level feedback queuing, or no, by just doing useless I/O in order to remain at that high priority. That, like, this has some problems there. And we also, I believe, finished up saying that we have a starvation problem, that because it's approximating SRTF, that if we have things which take a long time, they might not run. They might be starved. So commonly, when you see real OSs implement multi-level feedback queues, they'll implement a version where there's some extra stuff to prevent starvation. That after a while, they say, okay, this has run for too long, we're going to boost its priority just because it's not run for long enough. So instead of approximating SRTF, they're approximating some sort of SRTF, but a little more fair, as just a deliberate design choice, because the starvation is so bad, even though they usually want SRTF. And note that multi-level feedback queues are an example of a particular heuristic. There are other heuristics we could imagine for achieving the same goal. So we could say, maybe instead of estimating your CPU burst length by how long you used the CPU the last time, we estimate that if you've been idle for a while, you're likely to have a short CPU burst, and if you haven't, you're not. That's also a heuristic. It might be wrong. It's probably more likely to be wrong than based on your last CPU burst, but it's going to be wrong in different cases, right? Whether your last CPU burst is right depends on whether your program alternates between long and short bursts of CPU. Whether this heuristic is right, it depends on whether things which do long waits for I/O actually have short CPU bursts or not. And there's a bunch of other policies we could use in the same vein, even to achieve the same goal. These are all guesses. Another thing to note is multi-level feedback queues are an example of a common thing you see in these sorts of OS problems where you separated the policy from the mechanism. So our policy is this shortest job first like policy. And the mechanism we're actually using to implement that is this priority mechanism. Fundamentally, it's a priority scheduler, but we have our policy which sets those priorities in order to achieve, you know, a certain goal. And we're going to look at another thing that's kind of like priority scheduling in the same way, where we could imagine, we're not going to go through it, we could imagine setting the parameters to achieve a particular goal, but we're going to have this flexible mechanism like priorities where we can do a lot of things depending on how we set the priorities and manipulate the priorities, which is basically what you can think of multi-level feedback queues as most of what they're doing. It's not all of what they're doing because they change the length of the time quantum, but it's a lot of what they're doing. And we're going to talk about this with fairness. So we've optimized our schedules for throughput. We said for throughput, just avoid context switches. So first come, first serve does it. We've optimized for this turnaround time or in wait time, at least the mean turnaround time and wait time, by doing this multi-level feedback queue as a practical approximation. Let's talk about doing fair. What's the fairest thing we can do? And an intuition you might have is that, you know, we don't have a definition of fairness, so we're not going to prove it formally, but like for many of those definitions, you might say, well, fair is if, you know, we have an equal chance of choosing everyone. So that gives us to a simple scheduling algorithm, which is just choose uniformly at random from the runnable threads. So this is very fair. It's not great for response time because often we won't choose the thing which most, you know, needs to run to get this good turnaround or wait time. It's not good for predictability because our scheduler will deliberately do different things sometimes. So sometimes you'll get unlucky. But it intuitively matches our notion of fairness. And we're going to talk about a scheduling algorithm that basically is an extension of this exact policy. And in fact, that's going to be our next assignment, is implementing that scheduling algorithm in XV6. So let's talk a little about measuring fairness, just, you know, so we have a way of doing that. So one way we can measure fairness, that's just as a concrete example of how we might measure it, is with this notion of max-min fairness. That the fairest schedule is the one that maximizes the minimum resources anyone gets. So under this notion, we would say that if these bars, the length of the bar represents how much CPU time each of four threads get, then this schedule is fairer than this schedule because the minimum time gotten here is this much versus this much, which is smaller. And this schedule, this third schedule, is fairer than the last one because the minimum time here but of this first thread is smaller than the minimum time of the three threads in the third case under this notion. And you can see peeking out between this ordering that you could come up with arguments where you might not agree with this ranking. So we've made a choice, and this is why fairness measures are hard, but this is one concrete way you could measure fairness and therefore tell more formally, does this schedule actually maximize fairness? And as far as our random schedule, you'd say, well, in expectation it does, assuming these threads are always runnable. Like in expectation, we end up with something like the first schedule, but there's a random factor, so it's probably not actually optimizing fairness. You know, overall, we'll see something which might do that a little better later. But it does pretty good for this metric and pretty much all the other metrics you come up with. Now, this is one notion of fairness, which assumes that fairness means everyone gets the same share. And maybe that's not our notion of fairness. Maybe threads aren't equally important. So we want some notion of something like priority, but we don't want the same sort of notion we have with priority scheduling, where we said that if a thread has higher priority than another, it should always run instead of that. We want something where we say, if a thread is twice as important, it runs twice as much. That's the intuition we're going to go for. And if we think about our fairness definition, one way we might put that in fairness is we might say that we maximize the minimum you get after scaling for how important you are. That if you're twice as important, you should get twice as much time. You know. And we should scale that way when counting that maximum of minimums. Minimum scaled by your importance. So this idea that if a thread is twice as important, it should run twice as much, this notion we're going to call proportional share, so that each thread is going to have its share that it deserves, and we're going to schedule in proportion to those shares. And the scheduler we're going to have you implement is something known as lottery scheduling, which is a version of this that uses that random idea, that we're going to choose randomly what thread to run, but instead of choosing uniformly, we're going to choose based on how important the thread is. And a way we can think of this is that we're going to run little lotteries, that each thread is going to buy a bunch of lottery tickets, or be given a bunch of lottery tickets, based on how important it is. Each of them has a number, and we're going to choose one of those numbers every time we need to decide what thread to run, and if a thread's number gets chosen, it gets to run. And if thread B in this case is twice as important as A and C, it's going to have twice as many tickets as A and C, and therefore be twice as likely to run as A and twice as likely to run as C. Yes? So in these, are we letting the programs finish or are we giving them one time? So I haven't specified what we do for preemption. For what we have you implement, we're going to have you do basically round robin, but instead of choosing the next thing, you choose based on this policy. So we're going to have a time limit for our quantum. So we can think of this lottery scheduling as sort of something we can use to achieve the same types of goals we achieve with priority, where we say that some threads are more important than others. We assign these ticket counts, and we can assign them based on our goal. So if we wanted to approximate something like shortest remaining time first, we make the programs we think will have less remaining time have more tickets. And it's worth noting that you can pretty tightly approximate priority by just assigning, absurd ratios of tickets. That if you give one program a million tickets and another 1,000, another one, that's very close to priority. And you can trade off how close you are to priority versus how fair things are based on the ratios of tickets you assign. If you make this 1,000 to 1, you're very close to priority. If you make it like 10 to 1, you're not further from priority, but have a fairer schedule. You'll have less starvation. Okay, so questions on this idea of approximating priorities. Yeah.
Did you say 10 to 1 would be the same priority?
So 10 to 1 would be further away from priority and closer to our, like, so we'd have less starvation, so it'd be more fair in that sense, but further away from priority. So you can, like, kind of have a knob to choose how close to real priority scheduling do you want to get. If you do something like this, you're very close because it's like 0.1% of the time it's not like it. If you choose something with that's more like 10 to 1, you're much further away, but you'll have a lot less starvation. Okay, so, and something worth noting is that if A isn't running, then our lottery is going to be only in these 1,001 tickets. So it still works like priority that when A isn't available to run, we do a lottery with it. And everyone who's in the queue, so only B and C will participate, so B will probably win most of the time. Okay, so that's our, yeah. And this is gonna be our assignment after the shell assignment. Just add it to XV6, it's going to be basically, you're going to take XV6 as round robin, but instead of every time you would switch between processes, you know, based on either the time slice expiring or a process like reading from the keyboard or something, you'll choose the next process based on this lottery system. You have to decide how many tickets each program has. For our assignment, we just have you add a system call to set the number of tickets. We also have you add accounting for how long programs run, because otherwise it's really hard to figure out if your scheduler is doing the right thing. If you don't know what programs are running, if you have to guess by, well, it computed this faster with my scheduler than the other one, so it probably works. It's not very helpful. Like, you could work that way, but it's not fun to test. And there's some simplifications over if you implemented this with a, you know, in a real OS, and, you know, we really cared about this. So one thing is that we're not going to be concerned if your scheduling decisions are linear time. If you were implementing lottery scheduling in practice, that would be very concerning. If you have like 10 processes running, you don't want to be have the scheduling decisions actually look through the whole list of processes, probably. And if you have 100 processes running, you definitely don't want to do that. But we're going to be fine with you, like, scanning the list of processes every time you want to run a new one. Even though there is a faster way of doing it, it's just pretty complicated to implement, and this is not a class on algorithms for maintaining sets of ranges and finding out which range something is in quickly. Also, in a real lottery scheduler, you might say, well, if we have our approximation of priority here, and A isn't running and A becomes runnable, we probably actually would want to do something to decide whether A gets to run. We're not going to worry about that. We're just going to say, you don't change when new processes get to run. You just replace the scheduler. You don't change any of the logic about when we schedule a new process in XV6. It just happens the same time it happens with the round robin policy now. Okay. So that's what the assignment will be after the shell assignment. Okay. So one question is, well, is lottery scheduling any good? So it kind of seems like a crazy proposal, mainly because we're, like, making random decisions. Now, it was seriously proposed by academics, and there's a 1994 paper published at the OSDI Operating System Design and Implementation Conference, and included things like, how do you make it efficient? How do you not do a linear time decision, but do a log time decision? How do you make preemption decisions in a way which makes sense, which we won't talk about, but like something where if that process A, which has a million tickets, comes along, that you usually decide to run it based on how many tickets it has, how you do something intelligent about a process not using its whole time slice if you want to implement something like multi-level fair queuing, not fair, multi-level feedback queues, you know, approximate that on top of it. How do you do scheduling for not the CPU? So all the sorts of things doing it. And it's a really elegant mechanism that can implement a lot of policies because we can just set the ticket counts to do lots of things, especially with these extensions to deal with preemption and not using whole time slices intelligently based on those policies. But there are some problems. And let's look at one of the probably the big problems, which is why you will not find an actual OS which uses this policy, uses this mechanism, I should say. So let's say we have process A with one ticket, process B with 9. And they're always runnable. They can just use all the CPU they can. So over 10 time quantum, what is the probability A runs at least 3 times? And one approximation, this is not something you're going to compute exactly in a minute, but hand at least. So, like, what range is it in? Anyone tell me? Like, give me a guess as like to, like, is this like
0.1%? It's a number, so like, is it the proportion of tickets it has to the total, like the probability that you'll choose it?
So what we're doing is every time we need to decide what to run, we have these two processes. So A has a 1/10 chance of being chosen every time, and B has a 9 out of 10 chance of being chosen every time. So the mean behavior is that A runs one time quantum every 10, and B runs 9. Yeah?
I'd say around 28%,
maybe 30%. So, but you're saying that's around 20 or 30%, and what was your logic for that sort of estimate?
I don't know.
Okay. But something worth noting is the question I'm asking here is what is the chance over a 10 time unit window that it runs 3 times more than it's supposed to? And it turns out it's around 7%. And the way you compute this is by having taken and remembering a probability class and learning that this is kind of like a binomial distribution, or just running a simulation to make sure that you don't forget what the binomial distribution is, which is what I did here. And you get around 7%. And if you actually look up the binomial distribution, you can see like this is sort of the probability curve. So this is what we don't like about our lottery scheduler, is that in this simple case, you know, this is the behavior, this one time here is the behavior we're aiming for. And if we look over 10 time units, we get that 40% of the time. But there's a lot of variance. There's a lot of cases where we're lucky or unlucky, depending on your point of view, and A either doesn't get to run for longer than it's supposed to, or A runs more often than it's supposed to by a bunch. So we have this 7% where it runs 3 or more times, and pretty often it runs twice as much, and it's true that over the long term, like this is going to kind of even out. We'll have a nice tight bell curve the way our statistics will work out. So if we're only concerned about the long term, that's not a big deal. But when we're talking about CPU scheduling, we often care about the short term because we care about, like, when I press a key, how fast is it going to be for something to run? And we can think of that here, that if that's what I cared about, then when I press a key, the question is probably how long does it take for process B to get its CPU time? And what we're saying is that 7% of the time when I press a key, it's going to be slower, a lot slower, because process A gets to run even though it's not supposed, more than it's supposed to. So questions on this idea? Yeah.
I guess just in general, is it also concerning that A would not run at all? 4% attack, or are you more just...
So the question, is it also concerning A when it runs at all? Yes, that's also concerning. It's less concerning because it's off by one, but yes, it's concerning, especially since we still have that when we think of like 20 time units we're expected to run two and so on. Yeah, so it's bad in both directions. It's just not, like, it averages out to this policy, but there's a significant amount of variation. So this is something that we're not gonna like about this policy, and one reason why real OSs do a different strategy to achieve the same fairness goals, which is not susceptible to this problem. We'll talk about what that is for Linux. Linux has a scheduler which tries to do proportional share, but it doesn't use the lottery mechanism, probably mainly because of this issue. Another thing about the lottery scheduler is how, you know, setting the ratios actually ends up working out for different types of programs. So if we think of having a CPU-bound program and a not IO-bound program, if we just set their proportional shares evenly, they run equally when both can run, but we don't actually give any credit for process B often not needing the CPU. So this means that B is going to run less than A, even though they have the same number of tickets, just because B is runnable less of the time. And you could say, well, that's fair. B is getting half of the CPU when it's able to use it. It's getting its fair share. Or you could say, well, that's not fair. I expect the long-term behavior to be that B gets half the CPU. So depending which policy you care about, you can say that this is the right thing to do or not. We're going to look at mechanisms of saying, well, really, maybe B should get more share. So with our lottery mechanism, one thing you might say is something we should add to this policy is if we want B and A to have the same share, then B should get some compensation for waiting and not and giving up the CPU for A. That's what you think. And we'll have a sit talk about another way of dealing with this. So questions on this problem? Saying that. So the lottery mechanism, because the problem you can think of here is fundamentally that it just doesn't have any memory. It doesn't remember what happened, which is very nice from an implementation point of view. We don't need to track any extra state. We don't need to keep track of what happened recently. But it means that we don't have long-term fairness. We have short-term fairness as far as if you have the same share, what does that mean? It means that as long as you're both able to use the CPU, it's fair. Over the long term, it might not be if you have different demand for the CPU or whatever resource is being scheduled. Okay. So these are the problems with the lottery scheduler. So we're gonna talk about a fix for this. And this is gonna talk about the scheduler that Linux has chosen to use, which is another proportional share scheduler, but it has a very different way in which it's implemented. And the lottery scheduler, you saw that variance was the problem, so it was consistent over the long term, but over the short term it was inconsistent. And we're gonna have something which is gonna be more like weighted round robin. If we think about our case where we said A had 9 tickets and B had 1, that sort of thing, we want to run A 9 times, then B 1 time, A 9 times, then B 1 time. That's the sort of thing we want. That's what I'm meaning by weighted round robin. So we're gonna get something which is gonna produce schedules like that, where we're gonna do a strict alternation. We're not gonna have that variance. But obviously that means that we need to keep track of a lot more state. You need to keep track of what was running recently in order to do that. So Linux implements one of these schedulers. It's in fact a deterministic proportional share scheduler. So there's no random decisions whatsoever. And the Linux scheduler has decided that they don't like this situation as is. They don't want it to be the case that process B that does a lot of I/O doesn't get to use the CPU according to its share. So they're going to have a compensation for that as part of their deterministic scheduler. So having a proportional share is going to mean not just that you get that share when you're available, that means you get compensated for giving up the CPU for a while. In order, so over the long term, you get the same amount of CPU as someone with the same share. Okay. So, questions on this idea? Okay. So let's talk about Linux's scheduler. And this is the default scheduler in Linux. It turns out that Linux implements multiple schedulers, and the default has changed over time. So I believe this is currently the default scheduler, if you just download the Linux source code to compile it. Maybe not, your version of Linux might be configured differently, have been compiled differently, but if you just download Linux and compile it, this is the default scheduler. So it's a non-randomized scheduler. It makes every scheduling decision in log n time, where n is the number of processes. And this is important because if you're running at 10,000 processes, you would not like to be spending as much time deciding what to run as running it. And it favors interactive programs. And there's another component to this we haven't talked about much, which is that it adjusts time slices. So this is kind of like round robin, but a problem with round robin we had was that, well, it matters what the time slice is. If you set it too short, you're spending all your time doing context switches. If you set it too long, then you have a very high turnaround or wait time that, you know, might take a while from when I press a key to when I get a response. And that's the same thing is going to be true unless we make adjustments for that. So they try to adjust the time slices to deal with that problem. Try to get the right compromise. Okay, so instead of tracking, so we have something akin to the number of tickets, but we have to track information about each program to know, well, are you the next thing to run or not? And our notion is that we want each program to get to use the same amount of CPU time overall. So if we think everything has the same share, then we want it to use the same amount of CPU time. And in order to do that, what we can think of it as is that the next thing I should run is the thing which has used the least CPU time. So this is the basic policy that Linux's scheduler implements. It tracks virtual runtime for each thread. So each thread, we have a counter, which is how long has it used the CPU. And every time it runs for some time, we increment that based on how much CPU time it got. And our notion is that the thread which has used the least virtual runtime runs first, because it's the one which is most in need of the CPU. And if we go back to my fairness definition I showed you earlier, this is exactly the right thing to do for our max-min fairness, that we're taking the thing which has used the least CPU time and moving that number up, so we're exactly making it more fair by, say, in this case, we're taking the least CPU time thing, getting it to use more CPU, which increases our fairness measure. And the same thing here, we're taking one of these things which has used the least CPU, giving it more, and same here. That's how we improve fairness, so in that sense, it's fair in this maximum minimum time. We take the thing which has run for the least time and increment it. And this allows us to actually make our scheduling decision efficiently. So if you remember 2150, we talked about balanced trees, and that's what Linux uses to hold the processes sorted by their virtual runtime. So when they increment the virtual runtime, they remove it from the tree and insert it with its key at the new virtual runtime's place. And that's why the scheduling decisions are log n. It's just going to the left or rightmost thing in the tree and removing it. And so this works for things that are equally important. We just do this policy, and this gives us fairness over the long term. We also don't have to worry about if you aren't able to use the CPU all the time. Well, that's fine. Your virtual runtime doesn't increment when you're not available, and you'll get credit for that time later on. And I mentioned this was proportional share, not just fair. So we multiply the virtual runtime based on its proportional share. So if something is twice as important, we count its time as half, because it deserves more CPU time. So another thing we need to deal with is we don't want to give too much of an advantage for not using the CPU. So for example, if I start a new thread after my system has been running for an hour, I don't want to say, well, that new thread has run for an hour less than everything else, so let's run it for an hour before we run anything else. That would be very bad. You know, we want to be not have that sort of thing happen. So we have a limit on how much of an advantage you can have. So it's not too long term. So basically we say, well, if you're just starting or you haven't been running for a while, we're gonna cap the virtual runtime you have so it's not too long. We're gonna make sure that you are at least close enough to everyone else, so you're not going to be running for an hour and keep everyone else from doing anything. Even if you didn't get to use the CPU for an hour, we're not going to give you that much credit for not using the CPU. And obviously, this is a sort of policy decision about how much do you do that. If they make the adjustment so there's no advantage, then we're going back to our original lottery scheduler problem of something which isn't doing I/O half the time runs half as much compared to its share. If we go all the way, we have this situation where something that just starts up gets to run for days to catch up on our server. So we're going to choose something in between, and the Linux scheduler just has some default values that they have chosen for how far back you can get. So let's look at what this looks like. And here, I'm doing the simple case that we have three threads, A, B, and C, and they're always ready, and we're gonna choose 1 millisecond time quantums. So here, at time zero, I say, okay, these are my virtual runtimes. A has the lowest virtual runtime, so it runs first, so then I run A, and now A's virtual runtime is run for 1 millisecond, it's 1.5, and now B has the lowest virtual runtime, so it runs next, and then C has the lowest virtual runtime, so it runs next, and this is the same as round robin in this case. So if everyone's ready all the time, this is exactly round robin. That's exactly what we're doing. Except we're just keeping track of the amount of time people have used, but it's not doesn't change anything. So the difference is going to be when we have threads waiting for I/O. As I mentioned, we're going to need to adjust the runtime, and we're going to try to give them an advantage for waiting for I/O. We're going to say that if you spend a very short amount of time waiting for I/O, you deserve to keep using the still get your share of CPU. If you spend a long time, we're not going to give that all back to you because we don't want to spend minutes catching up for you. So what they'll do is when it comes back for I/O, we'll give it either its prior virtual time or a little less than the minimum virtual time of everything that's already running, already ready to run. So this means if you're not runnable briefly, you still get your fair share. If you're not runnable for a while, you get some advantage when you come back. The notion is that maybe you were waiting for the user to press a key and a minute later they did, you should still run first. This is kind of approximating SRTF encoded in this policy. Okay. So let's look at what that might look like, where A is doing these short CPU bursts followed by I/O. Okay, so here, I run A first because it has the lowest virtual time, and let's say it only runs for half a millisecond, so I'm going to record that, but it's not ready, so I'm not going to run it because it's not ready to run. It's waiting for I/O somewhere. or sleeping or something. And then B gets to run, or this should be, we probably, yes. So C probably should get to run if I was paying attention when I was made this. So we'll say that C actually has 2 milliseconds of virtual time, so it doesn't get to run, which will hopefully not cause problems in the lighter parts of this slide. So then, later on, B runs and A comes back, and now even though C would normally run next, but because A has credit for having used less CPU time when it comes back, we end up running it immediately. And then at that point, we actually run C as we'd expect. Okay, just off by one. We actually run C. Finally, when A is done,
I see what I did here. Okay.
So the way we make this actually match, and what I probably meant to do, is have C be at 1.5. So we don't choose it here because 0.25 is lowest. We don't choose it here because 1.25, the lowest runnable. And here we have 1.25, 0.75 is lower, A coming back, and here C is the first thing to run. And then we have 2.5 here, which means A gets to run next. So note that A runs 3 times because it started out with sort of a debt of CPU time it was owed. I'm sorry for apparently not proofreading these slides for math. So this is the basic algorithm that the Linux scheduler implements. We just track this virtual time. That's it. And we have this one adjustment for long sleep. So let's say A, instead of just coming back for IO a millisecond later, let's say A took 50 milliseconds. So we're running things normally. And then A comes back. What we're going to do is we're going to say, well, I'm not going to have A be at 1.5 because that would be way too much of an advantage over B and C. So what I'm going to say is that we'll give A maybe a millisecond advantage. We'll put A a millisecond behind when it comes back. And that choice is configurable. And because now A is the first thing, we're going to preempt C when it comes back. And then maybe A goes back to sleep and we just keep going on. So this idea makes sense. So we're just capping where we put A just to make sure that we don't give it too much of an advantage. But this has the effect that if it's been sleeping for a while, it at least gets to run immediately because it's ahead of everyone else. Yes? Why does A only run for 0.75? According to this annotation, it went to sleep after that, possibly to do more IO. Because the typical scenario where this would happen is that A is something which is like reading from the keyboard. So we press the key 50 milliseconds after it started reading. It processed that key press, and now it's reading again, let's say, for example. So notice the effect in that case, where A is doing lots of IO, where it does a little processing of the IO, is that it always runs immediately when that IO is ready, because it doesn't use its CPU otherwise, and it's always owed more CPU time because it doesn't use much CPU. Yeah.
It seems like if we had a bunch of long running programs and then we tried to start the program, it would get a huge advantage.
So the question is, if we have a bunch of long-running programs and we try to start a program, it would be a huge advantage. So this would be true, but we'll do this same policy here of when those new programs become ready, we'll set their time not to zero, but based on not giving them too much of an advantage, just like we did with A here. And that's how we deal with that. Does that make sense?
We consider the spawning of a thread as just a really, really long sleep.
Yeah. So in the notion I'm giving you, I'm not sure that's actually what Linux does. It might inherit the virtual runtime from the thing which spawned it, is I think more likely what happens. So I'm not actually sure, but I think it might inherit it based on fork, like might just copy it.
But it's not zero.
It's not zero. Definitely not zero. We don't want to give you, you know, hundreds of seconds of free time. Other questions? Yeah.
Wouldn't you have to reset them back to zero eventually?
So the question is, doesn't this wrap around? And the answer is eventually maybe. I don't recall exactly how Linux deals with it. I think their main way of dealing with it is that they use a 64-bit counter. So it takes a very, very, very long time for that to happen. Other questions? Okay, so that's policy. And as I mentioned, the other thing on top of this is that they handle proportional sharing. So what they'll do in practice is that programs will have some notion of priority. In Linux, there's something called a nice level. That's the actual name. There's a command called nice, which you can use to set it. And that controls sort of your weight as far as share, and they just multiply your CPU time based on that. So you get less of a share. So the other thing I mentioned we do, the Linux scheduler does, is it does something to quantum links. Because we have this sort of issue that if we just, you know, switch between programs very quickly, we're going to spend all our time doing context switches. If we switch too slowly, then we're not going to respond very quickly to a key press. So they have a policy for adjusting the length of the time quantum that they schedule when they start a process. And there are two priorities, and these are conflicting. So one priority is that they don't want to have too much time be spent doing context switches. And the way they avoid that is they just have a rule that we're not going to make the time quantum be smaller than a certain amount. That we're always going to let programs run for at least 3/4 of a millisecond by default. You can change that number. And they have a second priority, which is that they would like every process to run within 6 milliseconds of it being ready. And this is to avoid starvation. And that 6 milliseconds is configurable. So that, and these are in conflict. Like, you can't always do both. That's why there's a first and a second priority. So they're never going to make the time quantum go too short. So if you have lots of things ready to run, that might mean it takes more than 6 milliseconds for something to get to use the CPU when it's ready. So what they do is they say, we're going to set our quantum to be either we're going to divide up these 6 milliseconds among the number of runnable processes evenly. So if we have 3 runnable processes, we're going to give each of them 2 milliseconds. Or we're going to set it to the minimum if that would be smaller than the minimum. So the idea here is when we have less things to run, we'll get the programs run for longer because it will be as responsive to the user as otherwise, and we'll save some time doing context switches. When we have more things to run, we'll make the time quantum smaller and smaller, but not too small. Okay, so questions on idea? And note that this, yeah.
It's fixed window in this case is 6.
The fixed window in this case is the 6 milliseconds, yeah. Yeah, so, and note that this policy, it happens to be used in the case of this fair scheduler, but you could imagine using this for any scheduler. Like, it's just a generic rule set of rules for how do I set time quantums that tries to achieve, balance these two goals of responsiveness versus fairness. So another thing that they have to worry about is we saw preemption, that when that process A
became runnable, we stopped running process C because we decided, oh, you know, process A has been waiting for a while, we should run it right away. But this is another issue where you might not always want to do that. So there's this goal that we want, if something's newly ready and it's like according to our virtual time metric, it should run, we want to run it as soon as possible. But we don't want this to result in us switching between programs very often. We don't want it to end up that we set our time quantum to 0.75 milliseconds, but we end up, because things become ready, switching much more often than that. So CFS has this rule that it's not going to preempt a program early, it's not going to stop it before its time quantum is up, unless the new program has a significantly lower virtual time, not just a little lower, but a lot lower. And this constrains how many context switches you can have for that. Well, still, usually, when there's only like one program becoming ready, making it run immediately. And again, this is a sort of heuristic, you know, for both of these things are heuristics. It's not clear if they're always the best thing to do, no matter what you're optimizing for. But they're trying to navigate this sort of, we can either be very responsive or very fair. They're trying to get some in-between point that's good for everyone. Okay, questions? Okay, so I've given you like an overview of what Linux's actual scheduler looks like. But there are parts I'm not talking about because real schedulers are incredibly complicated on some OS like Linux, which has been under development for a while and where there's been lots of things people want the scheduler to do. So there are a whole bunch of things it doesn't deal with. Probably the most complicated thing that we won't talk about in this course that we could easily spend like several weeks on is how the scheduler deals with multiple cores, multiple CPUs, which I didn't talk about and is tricky. Like, if you have three things runnable, which core do you run things on? Do you want, because you want to run things on the same core so you can use caches, but you also would want to like run something immediately if another core is available. Like, how do you compromise between that? So CFS is a particular decision there. There's also issues of how do I send, you know, keep track of state for multiple cores at once without spending lots of extra time to do that. Also, there's things like handling related tasks. There's these special notions of idle or batch tasks. So you can say, I have something I want to run whenever the system is free, but not otherwise, and implements that somehow, so on. Okay. And so some of you might complain, why are we learning about the Linux scheduler? Why don't we talk, isn't that just only applicable to Linux? The scheduler that Linux implements is similar to schedulers you will see that are talked about in academia, even though maybe the Linux documentation doesn't acknowledge it so much, and you'll see elsewhere. So it's very similar to something known as stride scheduling. So the same people who wrote the academic paper on lottery scheduling had a follow-up on how you do it deterministically, and what Linux does is very similar to that. And it's very similar to something called weighted fair queuing, which is commonly used for scheduling network packets. So something completely different from CPUs for making networks share data between multiple users is basically the same algorithm that the Linux scheduler uses for scheduling processes. And this is what I mentioned earlier, then I said, we're only dealing with CPU scheduling, but the concepts port elsewhere. So it's basically the exact same algorithm, but for sending things on the network, a completely different problem, and it works very well in both cases, depending on what your goals are. Okay, questions on other schedulers? Okay, so a brief note on multiprocessors. I mentioned that's a big topic we didn't talk about. And this comes up with all the schedulers. And the big extra considerations are, I'll just mention what they are so you can realize why this is a huge topic we're omitting. So one thing is, I want two processors to schedule without waiting for each other. I don't want to have one process not be able to run, one processor not run something because the other is looking at the list of schedulable processes. And when we looked at XV6, XV6 didn't do that. XV6 said one person at a time goes through the process list. And that means XV6 doesn't achieve that goal. But we want what schedulers which do. We want to keep a process on the same processor to be better for the cache. But that might conflict with running things, you know, with the least context switches or being responsive to user inputs. And you have preemption questions. When I press a key and a program becomes runnable and I have three cores or four cores, which core do I preempt a program from? Like, that's a new decision we have to make. So let's go on to one more scheduling case for CPU scheduling. So far we talked about CPU scheduling for the desktop, where our usual notion was we had these I/O and we just wanted to do as good as possible. So this is not what you might call best effort scheduling. We're doing the best thing possible given our goals, whether it's throughput or response time. But there's another model of the world, which is that I need to make guarantees, that I have some deadlines imposed by the real world, and that's what my scheduler needs to do. It doesn't need to just give me the fairest share or the highest throughput. It needs to achieve some goal. So one example is if I want to process audio and like do some effects on it, I might want to have that happen in 1 millisecond so I don't have weird echo from doing that. Another example is if I have a computer-controlled cutting machine, I really want the motor to stop at a particular time, and I want my program that tells the cutter to stop to run at exactly that time and not some other time, or else I'm going to be very disappointed. And the same sort of thing with, like, if I have a brake and engine control computer in my car, I'd really like it to be the case that the program which handles me pressing the brake runs in a particular amount of time and not sometimes a little later. So this is known as real time. So we have these real constraints that we want to meet, and it's about meeting these deadlines, you know, not about sort of maximizing something. So a way you might look at this is we have a bunch of programs to run. So we have some CPU that programs need, and a time they're ready, and a deadline for each one. So here I have three threads. This yellow thread becomes ready, and it needs to finish by this deadline. This blue thread becomes ready, needs to finish by this deadline. This green thread becomes ready, it needs to finish by this deadline. And in this case, each of them need the same amount of CPU time to be done before the deadline, at which presumably like they'll do some output to some device that needs to be have information by a particular time. We need some audio by a particular time. We need to send a control signal to our brake by a particular time. You know, some event needs to happen by then. And if we do the naive things, we won't end up with the right policy. So if we do round robin, we'll miss a deadline. And the reason is that if you're like thinking of like doing your homework, if you had deadlines like this, what would your policy be in order to complete everything by the deadline? You know, if this was like homework assignments, yeah.
Do the first thing that's gotta do.
Yeah, do the thing that's due first. And that's exactly the scheduling algorithm you need for cases like this. It's earliest, deadline first. So this is preemptive in this case. So we always run the thing which is due first, so when this green thing becomes ready, we stop running the blue thing because it's due earlier. And in this way, we can meet all the deadlines. So this is priority, where priority is when's the next deadline. Okay? And this policy will meet all the deadlines, assuming it's possible to do so. But obviously, it can't always be possible. We move the deadlines over, then there might be no way to do it. So in addition to having the correct scheduling policy of do the thing that's due first, we need to have some policy which is going to say, in a situation like this, wait a moment, something's wrong. And if we're thinking about a case like a car with a brake controller, we would like to say something is wrong when you like compile your software. If we're thinking about the audio processing, maybe it's okay to say something is wrong later on. Like when you try to launch the program, we can say you can't do both of these things at the same time. So to handle this, we're going to need some notion of admission control, that we're going to run something to figure out, given I know how much CPU time everything needs, I know what the deadlines are for like my brake control thing, you know, is it possible to meet all the deadlines all the time given that? So we'll ideally run that in advance. How you do that is not a topic for this course, but there are ways of doing that and figure out, well, given my scheduling algorithm and all these start times and these deadlines, can it always work? If so, great, we'll ship it. If not, we have to do something else. Like maybe we need to have a more powerful processor so we have smaller run times, or have an extra core to handle these other tasks or something like that. But that's the model for these cases. So that's sort of how you deal with these real-time cases. So something worth noting is that the scheduling algorithm we looked at here, this earliest deadline first, it's the best for solving the deadlines. It doesn't solve other problems. It doesn't minimize response time, because just because something, you know, could finish earlier doesn't mean it's the thing with the shortest deadline. It doesn't maximize throughput, because we're going to context switch more often if that's what we need to do to meet the deadlines. And it doesn't maximize fairness, because things with shorter deadlines are going to run faster, as they should. Okay, so that's everything I have on scheduling. And here's my summary of the schedulers we talked about. So, what scheduler do you choose? Well, it depends what your goals are. And if there are goals which aren't on the slide, there might be different schedulers you would use. So, any questions about scheduling before we move on to briefly start talking about threads? Yeah. If you schedule based on a proportional method, you can't say it's fair. So as I said, there are multiple fairness definitions.
Right,
so there's a fairness definition that works for proportional share,
right,
which is like a fairness with a weight for each program.
So the deadline thing, when you say it doesn't maximize fairness?
So by pretty much any, well, you can come up with examples where by any fairness definition, like it won't, like the deadlines are such that it doesn't maximize it. The simplest example is that if we have something with very short deadlines, it's going to run a whole lot, and pretty much any fairness definition that might seem unfair by, you know, because we can starve things in order to meet our deadlines. Like most simply, if we have something, if the things which meet deadlines use all our CPU time, we might never run something with no deadline. Yeah, depending on your definition. But I'm saying for the definitions of fairness you'll usually see. The ones where you're not gonna look at a set of pictures like this for the definition and be like, yeah, that's kind of weird. It won't work, because it's kind of a weird definition which lets you have no CPU time or something and say it's fair. Any other questions? Okay, so let's talk about threads. And I mentioned earlier that we had threads versus process. And we started by doing each process has one thread. But now we're gonna talk about the different parts of the process. So we're gonna divide up We're going to have different multiple threads which all share some data. So they're going to have their own, all the threads are going to share the same files, the same process ID, the same code and data. So part of their memory is going to, you know, be used by all the threads. They're going to have each have their own stack. They're going to be able to access each other's stack because it's going to be the same address space typically, but you'll have to have a pointer from the other thread somehow. Like if you just push things on your stack, you're going to access something independent from all the other threads. So this is our multi-threaded process. And when we talk about implementing threads generally, we're going to say that we're going to split up the state of our program, unlike it happens in XV6, and say that there's a thread control block that has the thread state, so the registers, and maybe some other information. And the process state is going to be kept in a process control block that's going to be shared by multiple threads. When we do our scheduling decisions, we're scheduling threads. Each of the threads have a thread control block, and most simply, they have a pointer to a process control block that might be used by multiple threads. Okay, questions on this idea? So one thing that's worth mentioning is the strategy used by Linux to do this, which is that Linux doesn't actually have a separate process and thread control block. Instead, it has a single structure to represent a task, what it calls a task, and it has pointers for the address space, the open file list, and two threads in the same process just have pointers to the same thing. And the way Linux does threading launching is that it's just exactly like fork, except you call a system call, which instead of just copying, instead of copying things, it just copies the pointers for some things. So it instead of copying the open file list, we have a point, it just copies the pointer to the open file list. Instead of copying your page table, your address space, it has the pointer to the same address space. And that's the only difference. And this is sort of the simplest way of implementing threads. And this model means that you have no special logic for threads. They just look like processes. It's just that some processes happen to share the things we see shared in this diagram. Some processes happen to share files, happen to share PIDs. And this is the Linux model of the world. And this, the way that we're talking about implementing threads here, there's another choice we get to make, which is about who implements threads. So here, you know, our notion is that threads are implemented like processes. They're part of the kernel. All the system calls know about them, and so on. There's another way you can implement them, which is where that you can have the library code handle everything. We're not going to talk about that except to say that it exists. It's not popular. And the main problem is that we want threads to use multiple cores, and that's hard to do unless the OS scheduler knows about the threads. Because if you have two threads in your program, you want them to run on different cores. The OS scheduler decides what runs on each core. It should know about your two threads. Systems which don't do that, it's hard to take advantage of multiple cores, relatively speaking. But this is another model that exists, which we just won't talk about how that's implemented. So, mention threads, and there's going to be two things we're going to talk about doing with threads. One of which is concurrency, the other of which is parallelism. And these are going to mean slightly different things. So when I say concurrency, I mean different things happening at once. That I want, like one thread per user, the threads are going to do different things depending on what each user is asking to do. Or one thread per page in a web browser, like they're doing the same overall task, but they're doing different things depending on what's on the web page, what there is to do. Or like one thread to play audio while another reads from the keyboard, they're doing different tasks. Versus parallelism, where we're doing something that you would normally do, you know, as one task, and we're splitting it up into pieces and doing those pieces in parallel. But the threads are effectively doing parts of one big thing that we have to deliberately split up into multiple pieces to take advantage of threads, of having multiple sets of registers and things that can run on multiple cores and so on. Okay. So we're going to have you write code that uses threads. We're not going to have you implement threads. We're just going to have you actually use them. And we're going to use the POSIX API for threads, which is known as pthreads, P for POSIX. So let's go through an example here. So here's some code which does some concurrent stuff. We compute pi and print the class list at the same time. And the way we do that is we spawn two threads, one thread to run the compute pi function, another thread to run the print class list function, and once we start them, they start running those two things at the same time, so the scheduler will schedule the compute pi for a little bit, then it will switch to the print class list and back and forth, just like it would if they were separate processes. But in this case, they're part of the same process, so we have the same process ID, we have the same heap, and so on. So something to notice here is that this pthread create function, the first argument is a pointer to a thread identifier. So like we have a process ID, which is a number, and we use that to perform operations on processes like wait for them, we're going to have a thread ID, which is going to be this pthread t. You aren't allowed to know what the representation is. It's just a pthread t. You can pass it around, you can copy it, but it could vary between systems exactly what's inside it. So you just use it as a pthread t without looking inside it. But this is what you'll pass to other functions which do things like wait for a thread. We also have the function to run. So rather than the thread starting at main, like execv does, or starting by returning to from the pthread create function twice, which we could have done, but decided not to do in this API, the thread's going to start with a clean empty stack, a new empty stack running the function you pass it. So that's where the thread starts, and when that function finishes, the thread's done. Also, there are two other arguments which I've passed null for here. So the first one are thread attributes. So there are extra settings you can set for the thread. An example is the size of the stack for the thread. And the function argument. If you notice, our functions here have this argument that they take. And if you wanted to pass in something other than null, you'd put something other than null in this last argument for pthread create. And in this way, you can have one function which does different things depending on its argument. So you can spawn multiple threads all running the same function, rather than writing one for each possible case. Yes?
Wait, it's like, what is the type of argument?
It's this question, what's the type? The type of the argument is void star. The type of the return value is void star. This is the choice made because it's a C API. Any other questions on this? Yeah. What if you need the return value? We'll get to that next time. Okay, and before I finish up, here's a little mystery we'll start with next time. So here's a function which starts a prints about to start the thread, it runs the thread, and then prints done starting thread. And when I run it on my machine, it outputs in the thread, which is what the thread does. It does do that, but only 4% of the time. So we'll start with this problem next time.